Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict holds his Wednesday general audience at his summer residence of Castel Gandolfo near Rome after a month-long suspension in July. World Youth Day hopes. As the countdown continues to the Church's World Youth Day gathering in Madrid later this month, we talk to a young person from New Zealand and another from Ireland about their expectations ahead of attending this event. And how the papacy changed Rome. We explore some of the less well-known ways in which past popes changed the face of the Eternal City, by rescuing from ruin its historical monuments like the Colosseum or the Pantheon, by building hospitals, fountains, straight roads and obelisks, and by opening the world's first ever public museum. Benedict greeted pilgrims at his Wednesday general audience, held at his summer residence of Castel Gandolfo near Rome, after a month-long suspension in July. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
During the summer, when we have time to relax, we must rediscover how great it is to read the Bible. In his first general audience since his July break, Pope Benedict XVI invited pilgrims at Castel Gandolfo Wednesday to use some of their vacation time to refamiliarise themselves with the beauty of the Bible. Thousands flooded the main square of the tiny hilltop village, which borders onto the main entrance of the papal summer residence. Appearing at first on the balcony overlooking the square, Pope Benedict said that each of us needs time and space for meditation, reflection and calm.
During these summer days, many of us find time to enjoy reading a good book. Today I would like to suggest reading through one of the many books of the Bible as a way of appreciating the beauty of God's word and the growing in knowledge and love of him.
Of course, the Pope observed many books are mostly for evasion, and yet, he added, many more are also dedicated to a more challenging reading. He described the Bible as a small library and encouraged pilgrims to look at some books which remain unknown or of which we have heard only certain passages of during the liturgy. Books such as the Book of Tobit on family and the marriage, the Book of Esther on the power of prayer, and the Book of Ruth on divine providence. These little books, he said, can be read through in 1 hour. Before pointing to more challenging and authentic masterpieces, such as the Book of Job, which tackles the great problem of innocent suffering, Ecclesiastes for its disconcerting modernity, which questions the meaning of life and the world, the Song of Songs, a beautiful poem symbolic of human love. The Pope also spoke of the New Testament, stressing the beauty of reading one gospel straight through, as well as the Acts of the Apostles or letters. He then reiterated his suggestion to keep the Bible on hand during the summer breaks, to enjoy it in a new way.
I greet all the English-speaking visitors present today, including the groups from the United States of America and from the islands of the Caribbean and Mauritius.
After his catechesis, speaking in English, the Pope greeted, among many others, a group of faithful from the Japanese city of Nagasaki, who on August 9th next will commemorate the 66th anniversary of the atomic bombing of the city during the Second World War. Amen. Then, before taking his leave, Pope Benedict emerged from the Apostolic Palace to personally greet the sick, the newlyweds, and those lucky faithful who were at the front rows for this, his first general audience in August. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Una buona giornata a tutti voi, buone vacanze.
Pope Benedict is heading to Madrid later this month for the Church's World Youth Day gathering that is expected to be attended by more than 1.5 million young people. Among those crowds of young people who will be flocking to the Spanish capital from all over the world for the week-long event is 21-year-old Richard Franson from New Zealand. He belongs to a Catholic youth mission movement called Net Ministries and has just finished a year-long mission in Ireland trying to re-evangelise young people there. He began by speaking to us about the challenges of this mission.
Some of the challenges, I guess, getting the young people to come out to the events or the retreats or anything that we were putting on. I was working on a stationary team, so I was placed in a diocese and working under the youth coordinator of the diocese, working alongside him, going into different parishes and throughout that 10 months trying to start up youth groups and going into schools and being a consistent presence, so more than just once. And yeah, the challenges was with the youth groups, just getting those young people out to the evenings. Usually once they came out to the evenings, they really enjoyed them and got a lot out of them and quite open. But the hardest thing was just getting them from the schools or the classrooms and out to these youth groups that we were doing. So,
were you expecting perhaps young people in Ireland to be more practicing, you know, given that Ireland is traditionally a highly Catholic country, a devoutly Catholic country?
Yes, sort of. It is a very Catholic country and most of them are Catholic. It's just, I guess, it hasn't really been passed on from their parents. And so these young people, although they do believe in God, they don't really follow much of the church and they don't really know much about what the church actually teaches. Obviously, what the media puts out there, they take a lot of that in and they think a lot of bad things about the church. And really, when we sit down and talk to them about what the church is actually trying to do, they actually are very interested and very open as well.
Now, of course, the church in Ireland has gone through a difficult phase with the sex abuse crisis there. Was that mentioned also? Do you think that could also have been a factor in why some people were just not wanting to have anything to do with the church, particularly amongst the young? Was it mentioned as a reason?
Yeah, there is. A lot of the young people do question that, and it does come up. And there is a lot of hurt there from the past. But just talking with them, they're usually pretty open and, like, there's no hiding some, like, there has been things that have gone on, and just saying to them, like, the church isn't trying to hide it and that the church is trying to do everything to try and do better from now on, you know.
Now, you're going to World Youth Day in Madrid. How many of you are going and what do you hope to get out of it? What are your feelings as you approach this event?
Well, I'm going with a group from Ireland, not actually with Net Ministries, but a different group. I'm not sure how many are in the group, but I'm really excited, and I have a couple of friends that I'm going with the group with. Yeah, I'm really excited to go for the week in Madrid. I haven't been to Spain, and going to the last World Youth Day, I had a really good experience and took a lot away from it, and really looking forward to going again.
And what were the things you really took away from it? What, for you, were the most valuable aspects to this experience of attending World Youth Day?
Well, I went to Sydney, Australia 3 years ago, and there was 500,000 young people. And for me, at the time, coming from where I was, there wasn't very many young people involved in the church, and I didn't see that young people were much a part of the church. And I guess just going to World Youth Day and seeing that many young Catholics that were excited about being Catholic, and just the energy and everything that was there, it really excited me to learn more about the church, because there must be something if all these people are going. Just that yearning to learn more, and so after then, the journey that I've been on and just learning more and more, I really want to go on again and share that with other people again. So.
And how would you describe the atmosphere at these World Youth Day gatherings?
It's just really exciting, a lot of singing and dancing, just a lot of joy and just having a lot of fun, no pressure from any people around you to do anything that you don't want to do, but just being able to be free and be who you are.
Do you get to meet a lot of people from other young people from other parts of the world and share experiences with them?
Definitely. I'm going with a group from Ireland, so there'll be a lot of Irish people that I'll get to meet, and just bumping into people in the school or the accommodation that you'll be staying in and meeting the other groups there. So you get to meet a lot of other people. It's really cool.
Okay. And what are your hopes for the future?
For the future, after World Youth Day, I'll be heading home to New Zealand in the near future and getting back into my studies at home.
Another 21-year-old heading to Madrid for the World Youth Day event is Senan Hill from the Archdiocese of Dublin, who's a choir master. It will be his first experience of attending a World Youth Day gathering. And he told us more about his expectations.
Madrid. I'm very excited. As you said, this will be my first time at World Youth Day. I believe it's going to be a new experience for me, one which, of course, I'm very looking forward to. I've been on other pilgrimages before. I've been to Knock in County Mayo in Ireland, where the Blessed Virgin appeared. But from what I've heard, World Youth Day promises to be a different experience entirely. As regards what I'm looking forward to, I'm looking forward to meeting other young people like myself from all over the world who are there to celebrate the church and the faith in Madrid, and of course to be in the presence of the Pope and of course make new friends while I'm there.
Looking perhaps at a very Irish aspect of young people today in Ireland, what would you see as the biggest challenges facing people your own age or the young people in that age group between 18 and 34 in the Ireland of today, which is a very different Ireland to even 10, 15, 20 years ago, for people who are Catholic and believers and also just for young people in general?
Well, as you said there, yes, Ireland is a very different country as it was 20 years ago. But times have changed. You know, social media, etc. does play a part in it. But there has always been a strong community of faith in the country of Ireland. And it has been and always will be ingrained in young people from a very young age. Well, we believe that young people will carry that forward throughout the rest of their lives.
Now, of course, young Irish pilgrims also have an extra responsibility at Madrid, because Madrid also marks the one-year mark from a very important event for the Irish Church and for the young people of Ireland who are the future of the Church in Ireland. And that is, of course, the International Eucharistic Congress, which is due to be held in Dublin. Will you be speaking to the pilgrims about it?
I won't personally be speaking to the pilgrims about it. I was at Knock in May, where there was a there's a letter read out from the Pope explaining that he's happy to see all the young people in Ireland express such a strong interest in the Eucharistic Congress. I believe the Eucharistic Congress will be a very strong message sent out from it.
My final question, Senan, is, of course, if you had, in a hypothetical world, if you had the opportunity to ask Pope Benedict XVI one question, perhaps about the faith, perhaps about the world, perhaps about himself, what do you think that question would be? During World Youth Day, the Pope has lunch with representatives from all five continents, young people. So a group of 10 young people are handpicked from the many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people who are there. And they're told, you're going to have lunch with Pope Benedict. And during that lunchtime, he asks some questions and they in turn also ask him questions. If you were to be one of those lucky young people, what do you think you would speak to the Pope about? What do you think you'd ask him?
Well, I would, first of all, congratulate him on leading such a strong community. But as regards the question, I would say, where do you see the church in possibly 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time down the road? Will it be stronger? Will it be weaker? Where do you see the church?
So finally, my last question is for you as a first-timer, if we can call you that, to World Youth Day, your first time round.
Yeah.
We hope the first of many other World Youth Days for you, Senan. What for you is going to be, what is the highlight of World Youth Day?
Well, I suppose from what I've been told, the highlight of World Youth Day will be the evening vigil with the Pope on Saturday. I look forward to hearing what the Pope has to say and to be able to take that home to my local parish in Ireland, whom I'm representing.
That was Senan Hill from Ireland. And earlier you heard the voice of Richard Franson from New Zealand. The beautiful historic city of Rome is one of the most popular tourist destinations in the world, with over 7 million pilgrims and tourists flocking to the Eternal City each year to admire its spiritual and architectural marvels. Everyone knows that without the papacy, there would be no St. Peter's Basilica or Vatican museums to visit. But far fewer tourists realize that without the foresight and vision of past popes, a large number of Rome's top historical monuments, like the Colosseum or Pantheon, would almost certainly have fallen into complete ruin or been destroyed. Another of the many papal contributions to the city was Rome's straight roads and obelisks.
that were built to make the holy sites more accessible and easy to find. To find out more about some of those less well-known ways in which the papacy changed the face of Rome over the past centuries, I sat down with Liz Lev, who teaches Christian art and architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University.
Well, the Colosseum, if you think about it, it's a pretty problematic monument for the Christian world. I mean, this is a building that was set up simply for an entertainment of blood sport. Why on earth would the Christians take any interest in preserving something that...
Where they would be thrown to the lions.
I mean, on top of everything else, there is a history of the martyrdoms in the Colosseum. So why would you go to the trouble of keeping a building that was set up to represent the absolute worst of the Roman Empire? And at the beginning, the church wasn't in a position to take care of it. When the fall of the Roman Empire, the church had no authority to take care of it, no resources. And so for many years, the Colosseum was actually used as housing. It was taken over as a private family fortress by the Frangipani family, of all things, in the 11th century.
And how long did they live there?
They had it for several hundred years, and they used it as kind of their own private stronghold in Rome. They were dismissed from that stronghold in around 1300s, and then it was hit by an earthquake. So the Colosseum was struck by an earthquake in 1349, which crumbled the entire southern wall, popped the seats out. And so what do you see there? An ancient building that serves no function whatsoever, but it has a giant bunch of cut stones on the ground. And in the beginning, in the 1400s, everybody took those cut stones to rebuild things, including St. Peter's. So yes, at the beginning, the papacy used these bits of travertine on the ground to help build what was going to be a far greater and more noble building, which is St. Peter's. But as the years went by and that building began to be picked away, and gradually the original surface was disappearing, and the memory of this great piece of engineering was about to be lost, the popes turned around on their position and they said, wait a minute, this is a martyrium. It's a site where Christians had died. This is 1754. And secondly, this is a memory of the great achievements of the Romans in engineering and a reminder of the kinds of things that these people were willing, the lengths that people were willing to go to for entertainment. And so they protected the building. They declared no more quarrying. It was to be preserved as a martyrium.
So which pope was it that was responsible for ordering the building of those wedges, which supported?
Exactly. So in 1815, Pius VII, who has a ton on his plate, he has just spent an entire pontificate dealing with the ravages of Napoleon. On top of everything else, in the last years of his papacy, he looks to the Colosseum and realizes it needs emergency restoration maneuvers. So he begins the wedge that will hold up the Colosseum. Anybody who's seen the Colosseum sees the white travertine arches, and then there's a brick wedge, which is still holding it up to this day. And on the other side, his successor, Gregory XVI, because Pius VII died almost immediately afterwards, Gregory XVI completed it with the other wedge. And the papacy continued to take care of that building over the years until finally the Italian government took over, and now they watch over the Colosseum.
Now, another of Rome's most popular tourist destinations is the Pantheon. It's one of its best preserved historical monuments, very ancient. Tell us a bit about that. I mean, you said it was built in the swampy lands of the Campus Martius, right?
Well, I think your most important statement is one of the best preserves. Who do people think preserved these buildings? When we have the barbarian invasions, we have utter poverty, we have destitution, we have a population that goes from 800,000 in 330 with Constantine to 25,000 between 700 and 800. And yet the church found it in itself to take hold of these buildings, to watch over these buildings, to allow them the privilege of becoming churches so that they would survive to this day. So, for example, the Senate House became a church. That's why we can still visit the ancient Roman Curia. The Temple of Antoninus Pius and Faustina became a church. The Temple of Fortuna.
And the Pantheon, then, which pope was responsible
and
there?
And the Pantheon is the first one. The church did not want to take these pagan buildings. First of all, structurally, they were small, dark, and they had pagan god cooties, so who wanted them anyway? But the Pantheon was special. The Pantheon was an extraordinarily beautiful building, a monument to human genius. And so on May 13th of 609, Pope Boniface IV asked the Byzantine emperor, because it was not his city to control, he asked the Byzantine emperor to give him the Pantheon so that the Pantheon could continue to live as a church, where it would be cared for, where it would be watched over, where it would be restored under the funding and attention of the Catholic Church. And that is why so many tourists have that wonderful photo op, that magnificent experience, which if they think about it, It's free. Who pays a ticket to go into the Pantheon? You put that church anywhere else in the world and you would pay, you pay a ticket to go into Hagia Sophia, but you don't pay a ticket to go into the Pantheon because it's a gift.
Okay, so we've looked at the Colosseum and the Pantheon, the two of the perhaps top historical monuments, but what other monuments have we to thank the papacy for in the past where they've stepped in and stopped a monument from crumbling to ruin?
Really, there's so many comforts that the tourist takes in for granted when one comes to Rome. And I take so for granted that when I go to other cities, I'm always surprised. I don't have a nice, cool church I can sit in and just read my map and get my bearings and try to figure out where to go. And yet, what have we got? 900 churches open in the morning, open in the afternoon. The papal basilicas open all day long. Always a place where you can go and sit and be quiet with, as I said, free bathrooms. And then you have the water fountains. You don't necessarily have to buy a €3 bottle of water. You can get yourself a bottle and you can fill it up from our hundreds upon hundreds of free fountains. That idea, which began in ancient Rome under the great pagan aristocrats who built the first aqueducts, was picked up by the papacy in the 1400s, and they were strategic fountains placed throughout the city so that pilgrims on their way here who were tired, who were thirsty, who were lost, they could take a few minutes, have a sip of water, rinse off their hands and feet, and was just there, no charge.
And all these really famous fountains like the Trevi Fountain, the fountain in Piazza Navona, and of course at the Spanish Steps, they were all built thanks to
the papacy. Again, it's not only is there the useful, but there's the aesthetic. Not only is it a wonderful gift to be able to find fresh, cold water, but the papacy took this and made them into beautiful spaces. The Trevi Fountain begun, there's an idea under Urban VIII, completed with Clement the 14th. You find Urban VIII, who gave us the Triton Fountain, the Piazza Navona Fountain, which was from Innocent X Pamphili. Urban VIII also gave us the fountain in the Piazza di Spagna, in the Turtle Fountain, in the edges of the ghetto. All of these fountains, always gifts of the papacy.
And another gift of the papacy, of course, is its straight roads. I mean, I know it's got quite a labyrinth of little roads in the historical centre, but there's a lot of very straight thoroughfares that cross through the city that link the holy sites. Tell us something about how those came to pass.
Well, again, with sort of the complicated vicissitudes of the fall of the Roman Empire and the shifting of the remaining Roman survivors, if you will, into what we call the Campus Martius. That's the area around the Pantheon and the Piazza Navona. In that kind of complicated shift, people just built willy-nilly. And they're just a little, anybody who's ever walked around that area is always lost. I think those of us who've been here for 100 years, we're also lost. But when it came to connecting the major gates of the city to the major monuments, the papacy realized that pilgrims were coming in either walking through an urban design that looked like it was put together by a planner looking into a plate of spaghetti, or they were walking through a cornfield going, you know, is there a city in here someplace? Oddly enough, it's the Pope's name's Sixtus, who are always builders. So when you get a Pope named Sixtus, he's going to be building. Sixtus the Third, Sixtus the Fourth, Sixtus the Fifth. They gave us roads, they gave us churches, and they gave us very clear, straight thoroughfares so that the pilgrim, the person who wasn't a native, could be able to see from a distance where he was going or she was going, so that visiting the churches and the holy sites was not aggravated, or the difficulties that they already had were not aggravated by trying to find your way. I mean, before there were street maps that you could buy for, you know, a dime a dozen, before there was, you know, a GPS system on your phone, how do you think people get around? And these long, straight streets marked with obelisks.
Yes, the obelisks. I wanted to pick up on that.
What a wonderful idea.
Who first got that idea?
It was Sixtus the Fifth, again, 1585 to 1590, and his first obelisk move was in 1586 when he took the intact obelisk by the side of St. Peter's, the silent witness. That obelisk has been there since Peter died looking at it. And he moved it in an incredibly elaborate project from the side of St. Peter's to the front of St. Peter's. So the obelisk would be a beacon. This is the witness of where Peter died. Back here is where Peter is buried. And here you will see the successor of St. Peter, the church alive and kicking still today.
And a great landmark for tourists, particularly in areas where there were much lower buildings.
Particularly, so it made it very easy, but also the one in St. Mary Major, the one in front of St. John Lateran. Later on, they'll put one on top of the Spanish Steps in the Piazza del Popolo. It makes it so easy. You look in the distance going, where am I going? Oh, obelisk. Well, there's got to be something important there.
Let's turn now to museums. And we all know, of course, that we have the papacy to thank for this amazing collection of art housed in the Vatican museums. But I'm sure not many people know, I didn't know, that it was a pope who opened the world's first public museum in 1471 in Rome's Capitoline Hill. Tell us a bit about how that happened.
As an art historian and a Catholic, I am profoundly proud of this, that the very first public museum was opened by Sixtus IV in 1471. He had great plans to take Rome and turn it into a new Caput Mundi, a new head of the world, not in the pagan sense, but in a new Christian sense. He was building roads and libraries. He was opening up aqueducts. He was building the first bridge to cross the Tiber. And he realized that he needed the Roman people to be with him, not against him. So he took five bronze statues, which had been lovingly kept at St. John Lateran for centuries, protected through the sacks and the things over the years that had happened. And he gave those five statues on the top of the Capitoline Hill in this palace known as the Conservator's Palace. He gave these to the Roman people so the Romans could look upon their glorious past, their beautiful artwork, their great rulers, their remarkable achievements, and they could hope to have a glorious future. What a wonderful motive for a museum. He's the one who even gave us that image of the she-wolf with the two children as our symbol of Rome. That wasn't the symbol of Rome. The symbol of Rome in antiquity was SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus, Senate and People of Rome. And it was Sixtus who took that she-wolf, commissioned the two baby statues. They're so familiar to everyone underneath it, in a completely different spirit. A she-wolf. Who on earth would leave their kids with a she-wolf? I mean, that merits a call to child services now, doesn't it?
And there were other gifts given, weren't there, to this museum later on, weren't there, from the Pope?
The papacy continued to gift that museum, endow that museum with wonderful works of art. There was a huge exodus from the Vatican museums under Pius V, which just sent hundreds of works over into the Capitoline. That some of the more famous works, I think the ones that people would recognize are the wonderful Dying Gaul, perhaps one of the most statuesque and noble of the sculptures.
The Capitoline Venus
and the Marcus Aurelius, which was brought over although that was actually put in the Piazza. It only went to the museum in 2000. But it was brought over to that area under Paul III.
So all these came from the popes.
Exactly.
I also wanted to look at the hospitals in Rome. As you say, it's not just the culture and everything, but it's also about, taking care of people. I mean, Rome has been a centre of pilgrimage for so many centuries. The past popes did a lot on the hospital front, didn't they?
The papacy was very interested, not only, I mean, Sixtus IV in particular was deeply concerned about not only the well-being of the Roman people, but those many, many, many people who came to Rome as pilgrims. And so he built his hospital, which is the Santo Spirito, literally right next door to us. He built the Santo Spirito Hospital with its very modern-looking wards. It was very much a pave-the-way sort of hospital at the time. And then at the same time, they also built a hospice, or in the sense of, that word I always need to qualify a bit, in the sense of a place for pilgrims to be able to find food, meal, help, assistance of some sort. And so that was known as Trinità dei Pellegrini, the Church of the Trinities, or the Trinity for the Pilgrims. And that's right by the Ponte Sisto, right by the bridge that crosses to Trastevere. And that was the number one place where you would kind of keep an eye on how many pilgrims were coming, because that was the place that most pilgrims knew to go to stay.
I was speaking to Liz Lev, teacher of Christian art and architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.